My head felt big as the sky, and when I walked, I seemed to be tiptoeing on clouds of cotton batting. All of that. But this, too. The boss sitting in the Cadillac, all lights off, in the side street by a house, the time long past midnight, or in the country by a gate. The boss leaning to a man, Sugar Boy or one of Sugar Boy's pals, Heavy Harris or Al Perkins, saying low and fast, "Tell him to come out. I'll know he's there. Tell him he better come out and talk to me. If he won't come, just say you're a friend of Ella Lou. That'll bring him." Or ask him if he ever heard of Slick Wilson, or something of the kind. And then there would be a man standing there, with pajama tops stuck in pants, shivering, his face white in the darkness. And this, the boss sitting in a room full of smoke, a pot of coffee on the floor, or a bottle, saying, "Bring the bastard in. Bring him in." And when they had brought the bastard in, the boss would look him over low from head to foot, and then he would say, "This is your last chance." He would say that slow and easy. Then he would lean suddenly forward at the man and say, not slow and easy now, "God damn you, do you know what I can do to you?" And he could do it, too, for he had the goods.
This ends Disc 6. All the King's Men, Disc 7.
On the afternoon of the 4th of April, 1933, the streets leading to the Capitol were full of people, and they weren't the kind of people you usually saw on those streets. Not in those numbers, anyway. The Chronicle that night referred to the rumor of a march on the Capitol, but affirmed that justice would not be intimidated. Before noon on the 5th of April, there were a lot more wool hats and rednecks and Mother Hubbards and crepe de chine dresses with red clay dust about the uneven bottom hem, and a lot of clothes and faces which weren't Cocklebur and Crossroads, but County Seat and Filling Station. The crowd moved up toward the Capitol, not singing or yelling, and spread out over the big lawn where the statues were. Men with tripods and cameras were scurrying about on the edges of the crowd, setting up their rigs on the Capitol steps, climbing on the bases of the frock-coated statues to get shots. Here and there around the edge of the crowd you could see the blue coat of a mounted cop up above the crowd, and in the open space of lawn between the crowd and the Capitol there were more cops, just standing, and a few highway patrolmen, very slick and businesslike in their bright green uniforms and black boots and black Sam Brown belts and dangling holsters. The crowd began chanting, "Willie, Willie, Willie, we want Willie." I looked out of a window on the second floor and saw it. I wondered if the sound carried into the Chamber of Representatives, where they were yammering and arguing and orating. Outside it was very simple, out there on the lawn, under the bright spring sky. No arguing. Very simple. "We want Willie. Willie, Willie, Willie," in a long rhythm with a hoarse undertone like surf. Then I saw a big black car pull slowly into the drive before the Capitol and stop. A man got out, waved his hand to the cops, and walked to the bandstand there on the edge of the lawn. It was a fat man, Tiny Duffy. Then he was speaking to the crowd. I could not hear his words, but I knew what he was saying. He was saying that Willie Stark asked them to go peaceably into the city, to wait until dark, to be back on the lawn before the Capitol by 8 o'clock, when he would have something to tell them. I knew what he would tell them. I knew that he would stand up before them and say that he was still governor of the state. I knew that because early the previous evening, around 7:30, he'd called me in and given me a big brown manila envelope. "Loudon's down at the Haskell Hotel," he said. "I know he's in his room now. Go down there and let him take a peep at that, but don't let him get his hands on it, and tell him to call his dogs off. Not that it matters whether he does or not, for they've changed their minds." Loudon was the kingpin of the McMurphy boys in the house. I had gone down to the Haskell and to Mr. Loudon's room without sending my name. I knocked on the door, and when I heard the voice, said, "Message." He opened the door, a big, jovial-looking man with a fine manner in a flowered dressing gown. He didn't recognize me at first, just seeing a big brown envelope and some sort of face above it. but I withdrew the brown envelope just as his hand reached for it and stepped over the sill. Then he must have looked at the face. "Well, how do you, Mr. Burden?" he said. "They say you've been right busy lately." "Loafin'," I said, "just plain loafin'. And I was just loafin' by and thought I'd stop and show you something a fella gave me." I took the long sheet out of the envelope and held it up for him to look at. "No, don't touch, Bernie, Bernie," I said. He didn't touch, but he looked hard. I saw his Adam's apple jerk a couple of times. Then he removed his cigar from his mouth, a good cigar, 2-bit at least by the smell, and said, "Fake." "The signatures are supposed to be genuine," I said. "But if you aren't sure, you might ring up one of your boys whose name you see on here and ask him man to man." He pondered that thought a moment, and the Adam's apple worked again, harder now. But he was taking it like a soldier. Or he still thought it was a fake. Then he said, "I'll call your bluff on that," and walked over to the telephone. Waiting for his number, he looked up and said, "Have a seat, won't you?" "No, thanks," I said, for I didn't regard the event as social. Then he had the number. "Monty," he said into the phone, "I got a statement here to the effect that the undersigned hold that the impeachment proceedings are unjustified and will vote against them despite all pressure. That's what it says, all pressure. Your name's on the list. How about it?" There was a long wait. Then Mr. Loudon said, "For God's sake, quit mumbling and blubbering and speak up." There was another wait. Then Mr. Loudon yelled, "You! You!" But words failed him, and he slammed the telephone to the cradle and swung the big, recently jovial-looking face toward me. He was making a gasping motion with his mouth, but no sound. "Well," I said, "you want to try another one?" "It's blackmail," he said, very quietly, but huskily, as though he didn't have the breath to spare. Then, seeming to get a little more breath, "It's blackmail. It's coercion. Bribery. It's bribery. I tell you, you've blackmailed and bribed those men, and I don't know why anybody signed this statement," I said. "But if what you charge should happen to be true, then the moral strikes me as this. McMurphy ought not to elect legislators who can be bribed, or who have done things they can get blackmailed for." "McMurphy," he began, then fell into a deep silence, his flowered bulk brooding over the telephone stand. He'd have his own troubles with Mr. McMurphy, no doubt. "A small detail," I said, "but it would probably be less embarrassing to you, and especially to the signers of this document, if the impeachment proceedings were killed before coming to a vote. You might try to see about getting that done by late tomorrow. That should give you time to make your arrangements and to figure out as graceful a way as possible. Of course, it would be more effective politically for the governor to let the matter come to a vote, but he was willing to let you do it the easy way, particularly since there's a good deal of unrest in the city about the matter." He wasn't paying any attention to me, as far as I could tell. I went to the door, opened it, and looked back. "Ultimately," I said, "it's immaterial to the governor how you manage the matter." Then I closed the door and went down the hall. That had been the night of the 4th of April. I was almost sorry the next day as I looked out the high window at the mass of people filling the streets and the wide sweep of lawn beyond the statues in front of the Capitol that I knew what I knew. If I hadn't known, I could have stood there in the full excitement of the possibilities of the moment. But I knew how the play would come out. This was like a dress rehearsal after the show is closed down. I stood there and felt like God Almighty brooding on history. Which must be a dull business for God Almighty, who knows how it's going to come out. Who knew, in fact, how it was going to come out, even before he knew there was going to be any history. Which is complete nonsense, for that involves time, and he is out of time. For God is fullness of being, and in him the end is the beginning. Which is what you can read in the little tracts written and handed out on the street corners by the fat, grubby, dandruff-sprinkled old man with the metal-rimmed spectacles who used to be the scholarly attorney and who married the girl with the gold braids and the clear, famished-looking cheeks up in Arkansas. But those tracts he wrote were crazy, I thought back then. I thought, God cannot be fullness of being, for life is motion. I used the capital letters as the old man did in the tracts. I had sat across the table from him, with the foul, unwashed dishes on one end of it, and the papers and books piled on the other end, in the room over across the railroad tracks, and he had talked, and I had heard the capital letters in his voice. He had said, God is fullness of being. And I had said, you've got the wrong end of the stick, for life is motion. For life is motion toward knowledge. If God is complete knowledge, then he is complete non-motion, which is non-life, which is death. Therefore, if there is such a God of fullness of being, we would worship death, the Father. That was what I said to the old man, who had looked at me across the papers and fouled dishes, and his red-streaked eyes had blinked above the metal-rimmed spectacles, which had hung down on the end of his nose. He had shaken his head, and a flake or two of dandruff had sifted down from the sparse white hair ends which fringed the skull within which the words had been taking shape from the electric twitches in the tangled and spongy blood-soaked darkness. He had said then, I am the resurrection and the life. And I had said, you've got the wrong end of the stick. For life is a fire burning along a piece of string, or is it a fuse to a powder keg which we call God? And the string is what we don't know, our ignorance, and the trail of ash, which, if a gust of wind does not come, keeps the structure of the string, is history, man's knowledge. But it is dead, and when the fire has burned up all the string, then man's knowledge will be equal to God's knowledge, and there won't be any fire, which is life. Or if the string leads to a powder keg, then there will be a terrific blast of fire, and even the trail of ash will be blown completely away. So I had said to the old man. But he had replied, you think in finite terms. And I had said, I'm not thinking at all, I'm just drawing a picture. He had said, ha! The way I remembered he had done a long time back when he played chess with Judge Irwin in the long room in the White House looking toward the sea. I had said, I'll draw you another picture. It's a picture of a man trying to paint a picture of a sunset. But before he can dip his brush, the color always changes and the shape. Let us give a name to the picture which he's trying to paint. Knowledge. Therefore, if the object which a man looks at changes constantly, so that knowledge of it is constantly untrue and is therefore non-knowledge, then eternal motion is possible, and eternal life. Therefore, we can believe in eternal life only if we deny God, who is complete knowledge. The old man had said, I will pray for your soul. But even if I didn't believe in the old man's God, that morning as I stood at the window of the Capitol and looked down on the crowd, I felt like God, because I had the knowledge of what was to come. I felt like God brooding on history, for as I stood there I could see a little chunk of history right there in front. There were the bronze statues on their pedestals, on the lawn in frock coats, with the right hand inserted under the coat, just over the heart, in military uniforms with a hand on the sword hilt, even one in buckskin with the right hand grasping the barrel of a grounded long rifle. They were already history, and the grass around their pedestals was shaved close, and the flowers were planted in stars and circles and crescents. Then, over beyond the statues, there were the people who weren't history yet, not quite. But to me they looked like history, because I knew the end of the event of which they were a part, or thought I knew the end. I knew, too, how the newspapers would regard that crowd of people as soon as they knew the end of the event. They would regard that crowd as cause. A shameful display of cowardice on the part of the legislature. Allow themselves to be intimidated by deplorable lack of leadership. You could look at the crowd out there and hear that undertone in its cry, hoarse like surf, and think that the crowd there could cause the event. But no, it could be said, Willie Stark caused the event by corrupting and blackmailing the legislature. But no, in turn it could be replied that Willie Stark merely gave the legislature the opportunity to behave in the way appropriate to its nature, and that McMurphy, who sponsored the election of those men, thinking to use their fear and greed for his own ends, was truly responsible. But no, to that it could be replied that the responsibility belonged, after all, to that crowd of people, indirectly insofar as it had allowed McMurphy to elect such men, and directly insofar as it had, despite McMurphy, elected Willie Stark. But why had they elected Willie Stark? Because of a complex of forces which had made them what they were? Or because Willie Stark could lean toward them with bulging eyes and right arm raised to heaven? One thing was certain. The sound of that chant hoarsely rising and falling was to be the cause of nothing, nothing at all. I stood in the window of the Capitol and hugged that knowledge like a precious and thorny secret and did not think anything. I watched the fat man get out of the black limousine and mount the bandstand. I saw the crowd shift and curdle and thin and dissolve. I looked across beyond the now lonely and occupationless policemen, beyond the statues, frock coats, uniforms, buckskin, to the great lawn, which was empty and bright in the spring sunshine. I spewed out the last smoke from my cigarette and flicked the butt out the open window and watched it spin over and over to the stone steps far below. Willie Stark was to stand on those steps at 8 o'clock that night in a flood of light, looking small at the top of the great steps with the mountainous heave of the building behind him. That night the people pressed up to the very steps, filling all the shadow beyond the sharply defined area of light. Lighting apparatus had been mounted on the pedestals of two of the statues, one buckskin, one frock coat. They called and chanted, "Willie, Willie, Willie," pressing at the cordon of police at the foot of the steps. Then, after a while, out of the tall doorway of the Capitol, he appeared. Then, as he stood there, blinking in the light, the words of the chant disappeared, and there was a moment of stillness, and then there was only the roar. It seemed a long time before he lifted his hand to stop it. Then the roar seemed to die away, slowly, under the downward pressure of his hand. I stood down in the crowd with Adam Stanton and Ann Stanton and watched him come out on the steps of the Capitol. When it was over, when he had said what he had to say to the crowd and had gone back inside, leaving the new, unchecked roar of voices behind him, I told Ann and Adam good night and went to meet the boss. I rode with him back to the mansion. He hadn't said a word when I joined him at the car. Sugar Boy worked through the back streets, while behind us we could still hear the roaring and shouting and the protracted blatting of automobile horns. Then Sugar Boy shook himself free into a quiet little street where the houses sat back from the pavement, lights on inside them now and people in the lighted rooms, and where the budding boughs interlaced above us. At the corners where the street lamps were, you could catch the hint of actual green on the boughs. Sugar Boy drove up to the rear entrance of the mansion. The boss got out and went into the door. I followed him. He walked down the back hall, where we met nobody, and then into the big hall. He paced right across the hall, under the chandeliers and mirrors, past the sweep of the stairway, looked into the drawing room, crossed the hall again to look into the back sitting room, then again to look into the library. I caught on and quit following him. I just stood in the middle of the big hall and waited. He hadn't said he wanted me, but he hadn't said he didn't. In fact, he hadn't said anything, not a word. When he turned from the library into the hall again, a white-coated Negro boy came out of the dining room. "Boy," the boss asked, "you seen Mrs. Stark?" "Yes, sir." "Where, damn it?" the boss snapped. "You think I'm asking for my health?" "No, sir, I didn't think nothing. Where?" the boss demanded in a tone to set the chandelier tingling. After the first paralysis, the lips began to work in the black face. In the beginning, without effect. Then a sound was detectable. "Upstairs. She done gone upstairs. I reckon she done gone to bed. She... The boss had headed up the stairs. He came back almost immediately, walked past me without a word and back to the library. I trailed along. He flung himself down on the big leather couch, heaved his feet off the floor to the leather, and said, "Shut the goddamn door." I shut the door, and he leaned back on the cushions at about a 30-degree angle from horizontal and glumly studied his knuckles. "You would have thought she might wait up for me tonight," he said finally, still studying the knuckles. Then looking at me, "She's gone to bed. Gone to bed and locked the door. Says she had a headache. I go upstairs and there's Tom sitting in the room across from her room doing his schoolwork. Before I lay a hand to the knob of her door, he comes out and says she don't want to be bothered, like I was a delivery boy. 'I'm not going to bother her,' I said to him. 'I'm just going to tell her what happened.' He looked at me and said, 'She's got a headache and she don't want to be bothered.'" He hesitated, looked at the knuckles again, then back to me, and said with a hint of defensiveness in his tone, "All I was going to do was tell her how it came out tonight." "She wanted you to throw Byram to the wolves," I said. "Did she want you to throw yourself to the wolves?" "I don't know what the hell she wants," he said. "I don't know what the hell any of them want. A man can't tell. But you can tell this, if any man tried to run things the way they want him to half the time, he'd end up sleeping on the bare ground, and how'd she like that?" "I imagine Lucy could take it," I said. "Lucy," he said, and looked sort of surprised, as though I had introduced a new topic of conversation. Then I recollected that Lucy's name hadn't been mentioned. Sure, he'd been talking about Lucy Stark, he knew that, and I knew that. But as soon as the name Lucy was mentioned, to take the place of that she, somehow it was different. It was as though she had walked into the room and looked at us. "Lucy," he repeated. Then, "All right, Lucy. She could take it. Lucy could sleep on the bare ground and eat red beans, but it wouldn't change the world a damn bit. But can Lucy understand that? No, Lucy cannot." He was apparently taking a relish in using the name now, in saying Lucy instead of she, as though he proved something, or about her, or about himself by saying it, by being able to say it. "Lucy," he was saying. "She could sleep on the bare ground, and that's exactly what she's going to raise Tom to do, too, if she has her way. She'd have him so the 6-year kids would be plugging him with nigger shooters and then not bothering to run. He's a good stout boy, plays a good game of football, bet he makes a team when he gets to college. But she's going to ruin him, make him a sissy. Looks like I say a word to the boy and you can just see her face freeze. I called up here tonight to get Tom to come down and see the crowd. Was going to send Sugar Boy to get him because I wasn't going to have time to get home. But would she let him go? No, sir. Said he had to stay home and study. Study, he said, then didn't want him down there, that was it, me and the crowd." "Take it easy," I said. "That's the way all women treat their kids. Besides, you got to be a big shot by hitting your books." "He's smart, smart enough without being a sissy," he said. "He makes good grades in school, and by God, he better. Sure, I want him to study, and he better, but what I don't get is..." There was a racket out in the hall, voices, then a knock at the door. "See who it is," the boss said. I opened the door and in stormed the familiar faces, somewhat flushed, Tiny Duffy's in the lead. They ringed round the boss and wheezed and shoved and chortled. "We fixed him. We damn well fixed him. You're telling it we stopped that clock. It'll be a long time till next year." While the boss lay back on the cushions at his 30-degree angle, with his feet propped on the leather and his eyes flickering around from face to face under the half-lowered lids, you got the notion he was spying through a peephole. He hadn't said a word. "Champagne," one of the boys was saying. "Real champagne, a case in this honest-to-God stuff. French, from France. Out in the kitchen, and Sambo's icing up. Boss, it's a celebration." The boss didn't say anything. "Celebrate? It's a celebration. Ain't you going to celebrate, boss?" "Duffy," the boss said, not loud, "if you aren't too drunk, you can see I don't want this assing around in here. Take your rabble over to the other side of the house and stay out from underfoot." Then, in the silence of his pause, his eyes flickered over the faces again to come back to Duffy, to whom he said, You think you grasped the idea? Tiny Duffy did grasp the idea, but the others grasped it too, and I thought that I detected a slight competition among the brothers of the lodge to be among the first out. The boss regarded the fine paneling of the closed door for a couple of minutes. Then he said, "You know what Lincoln said?" "What?" I asked. "He said a house divided against itself cannot stand." "Well, he was wrong." "Yeah?" "Yeah," the boss said. "For this government is sure half slave and half son of a bitch, and it's standing." "Which is which?" I asked. "Slaves down at the legislature and the sons of bitches up here," he said, and added, "Only sometimes they overlap." But Lucy Stark did not leave the boss after the settlement of the impeachment trouble, nor even after the next election, when the boss came in for a second term in 1934. A governor can succeed himself in our state, and the boss succeeded himself with a vengeance. There never had been a vote like it. I suppose Tom was the reason she hung on. When she did leave him, there wasn't any noise. Health. She went to Florida for a long pull. When she got back, she stayed out of town at a little place her sister had, a poultry farm and hatchery just out of town. Tom used to spend a lot of his time out with her, but I imagine that by that time she figured he wasn't Mama's boy anymore. By that time he was a strapping fellow, cocky and fast on his feet, a natural-born quarterback, and he had discovered that something besides pasteurized milk came in bottles, and that approximately half the human race belonged to a sex interestingly different from his own. Lucy probably figured that she could do something to hold Tom down, and so there wasn't any absolute break with Willie. Now and then, but not often, she would appear in public with him. For instance, on that trip up to Mason City, the time the boss and I made the midnight visit on Judge Irwin, Lucy came along. That was in 1936, and by that time Lucy had been staying out at her sister's poultry farm for going on a year. The boss himself used to go out to the poultry farm occasionally to keep up appearances. Two or three times the papers, the administration papers, that is, ran photographs of him standing with his wife and kid in front of a hen yard or incubator house. The hens didn't do any harm either. They gave a nice, homey atmosphere. They inspired confidence. Chapter 4. That night when the boss and I called on Judge Irwin in the middle of the night, and when, burning the road back to Mason City in the dark, the car hurtled between the back fields, he said to me, "There is always something." And I said, "Maybe not on the judge." And he said, "Man is conceived in sin and born in corruption, and he passeth from the stink of the deity to the stench of the shroud. There is always something." And he told me to dig it out, dig it up, the dead cat with patches of fur still clinging to the tight, swollen, dove-gray hide. It was the proper job for me, for, as I have said, I was once a student of history. A student of history does not care what he digs out of the ash pile, the midden, the sublunary dung heap which is the human past. He doesn't care whether it's the dead pussy or the Kohinoor diamond. So it was a proper assignment for me, an excursion into the past. It was to be my second excursion into the past, more interesting and sensational than the first, and much more successful. In fact, this second excursion into the past was to be perfectly successful. But the first one had not been successful. It had not been successful because in the midst of the process I tried to discover the truth, and not the facts. Then, when the truth was not to be discovered, or discovered could not be understood by me, I could not bear to live with the cold-eyed reproach of the facts. So I walked out of a room, the room where the facts lived in a big box of 3x5-inch note cards, and kept on walking until I walked into my second job of historical research, the job which should be known as Case of the Upright Judge. But I must tell about the first excursion into the enchantments of the past. Not that the first excursion has anything directly to do with the story of Willie Stark, but it has a great deal to do with the story of Jack Burden. And the story of Willie Stark and the story of Jack Burden are, in one sense, one story. Long ago, Jack Burden was a graduate student, working for his PhD in American history in the State University of his native state. This Jack Burden, of whom the present Jack Burden, me, is a legal, biological, and perhaps even metaphysical continuator, lived in a slatternly apartment with two other graduate students. One, industrious, stupid, unlucky, and alcoholic, and the other, idle, intelligent, lucky, and alcoholic. At least, they were alcoholic for a period after the first of the month, when they received the miserable check paid them by the university for their miserable work as assistant teachers. The industry and ill luck of one canceled out against the idleness and luck of the other, and they both amounted to the same thing, and they drank what they could get when they could get it. They drank because they didn't really have the slightest interest in what they were doing now, and didn't have the slightest hope for the future. They could not even bear the thought of pushing on to finish their degrees, for that would mean leaving the university, leaving the first of the month drunks, the yammer about work and the ideas in smoke-blind rooms, the girls who staggered slightly and giggled indiscreetly on the dark stairs leading to the apartment, to go to some normal school on a sun-baked crossroads or a junior college long on Jesus and short on funds, to go to face the stark reality of drudgery and dry rot and prying eyes and the slow withering of the green wisp of dream which had, like some window plant in an invalid's room, grown out of a bottle. Only the bottle hadn't had water in it. It had had something which looked like water, smelled like kerosene, and tasted like carbolic acid. One-run corn whiskey. Jack Burden lived with them, in the slatternly apartment, among the unwashed dishes in the sink and on the table, the odor of stale tobacco smoke, the dirty shirts and underwear piled in corners. He even took a relish in the squalor, in the privilege of letting a last crust of buttered toast fall to the floor, to be undisturbed until the random heel should grind it into the mud-colored carpet, in the spectacle of the fat roach moving across the cracked linoleum of the bathroom floor while he steamed in the tub. Once he had brought his mother to the apartment for tea, and she had sat on the edge of the overstuffed chair, holding a cracked cup and talking with a brittle and calculated charm out of a face which was obviously being held in shape by a profound exercise of will. She saw a roach venture out from the kitchen door. She saw one of Jack Burden's friends crush an ant on the inner lip of the sugar bowl and flick the carcass from his finger. The nail of the finger itself was not very clean, but she kept right on delivering the charm out of the rigid face. He had to say that for her. But afterward, as they walked down the street, she had said, "Why do you live like that?" "It's what I'm built for, I reckon," Jack Burden said.
"With those people," she said.
"They're all right," he said, and wondered if they were, and wondered if he was. His mother didn't say anything for a minute, making a sharp, bright clicking on the pavement with her heels as she walked along, holding her small shoulders trimly back, carrying her famished-cheeked, blue-eyed, absolutely innocent face slightly lifted to the pulsing sunset world of April, like a very expensive present the world ought to be glad even to have a look at. Walking along beside him, she said meditatively, "That dark-haired one, if he'd get cleaned up, he wouldn't be bad-looking." "That's what a lot of other women think," Jack Burden said, and suddenly felt a nauseated hatred of the dark-haired one, the one who had killed the ant on the sugar bowl, who had the dirty nails. But he had to go on. Something in him made him go on. "Yes, and a lot of them don't even care about cleaning him up. They'll take him like he is. He's the great lover of the apartment. He put the sag in the springs of that divan we got." "Don't be vulgar," she said, because she definitely did not like what is known as vulgarity in conversation. "It's the truth," he said. She didn't answer, and her heels did the bright clicking. Then she said, "If he'd throw those awful clothes away and get something decent..." "Yeah," Jack Burden said, "on his $75 a month." She looked at him now, down at his clothes. "Yours are pretty awful, too," she said. "Are they?" Jack Burden demanded. "I'll send you money for some decent clothes," she said. A few days later, the check came and a note telling him to get a couple of decent suits and accessories. The check was for $250. He didn't even buy a necktie, But he and the two other men in the apartment had a wonderful blowout, which lasted for 5 days, and as a result of which the industrious and unlucky one lost his job, and the idle and lucky one got too sociable and, despite his luck, contracted a social disease. But nothing happened to Jack Burden, for nothing ever happened to Jack Burden, who was invulnerable. Perhaps that was the curse of Jack Burden. He was invulnerable. So Jack Burden lived in the slatternly apartment with the two other graduate students, for even after being fired, the unlucky industrious one still lived in the apartment. He simply stopped paying anything, but he stayed. He borrowed money for cigarettes. He sullenly ate the food the others brought in and cooked. He lay around during the day, for there was no reason to be industrious anymore, ever again. Once at night, Jack Burden woke up and thought he heard the sound of sobs from the living room, where the unlucky industrious one slept on a wall bed. Then one day, the unlucky industrious one was not there. They never did know where he had gone, and they never heard from him again. But before that, they lived in the apartment, in an atmosphere of brotherhood and mutual understanding. They had this in common. They were all hiding. The difference was in what they were hiding from. The two others were hiding from the future, from the day when they would get degrees and leave the university. Jack Burden, however, was hiding from the present. The other two took refuge in the present. Jack Burden took refuge in the past. The other two sat in the living room and argued and drank or played cards or read. But Jack Burden was sitting, as like as not, back in his bedroom before a little pine table, with the notes and papers and books before him, scarcely hearing the voices. He might come out and take a drink or take a hand of cards or argue or do any of the other things they did, but what was real was back in that bedroom on the pine table. What was back in the bedroom on the pine table? A large packet of letters. 8 tattered, black-bound account books tied together with faded red tape. A photograph, about 5 by 8 inches, mounted on cardboard and stained in its lower half by water, and a plain gold ring, man-sized, with some engraving in it, on a loop of string. The past, or that part of the past which had gone by the name of Cass Mastern. Cass Mastern was one of the two maternal uncles of Ellis Burden, the scholarly attorney, a brother of his mother Lavinia Mastern. The other uncle was named Gilbert Mastern, who died in 1914 at the age of 94 or 5, rich, a builder of railroads, a sitter on boards of directors, and left the packet of letters, the black account books, and the photograph, and a great deal of money to a grandson, and not a penny to Jack Burden. Some 10 years later, the heir of Gilbert Mastern, recollecting that Jack Burden, with whom he had no personal acquaintance, was a student of history or something of the sort, sent him the packet of letters, the account books, and the photograph, asking if he, Jack Burden, thought that the enclosures were of any financial interest, since he, the heir, had heard that libraries sometimes would pay a fair sum for old papers and antebellum relics and keepsakes. Jack Burden replied that since Cass Mastern had been of no historical importance as an individual, it was doubtful that any library would pay more than a few dollars, if anything, for the material, and asked for instructions as to the disposition of the parcel. The heir replied that under the circumstances Jack Burden might keep the things, for sentimental reasons. So Jack Burden made the acquaintance of Cass Mastern, who had died in 1864 at a military hospital in Atlanta, who had been only a heard but forgotten name to him, and who was the pair of dark, wide-set, deep eyes which burned out of the photograph, through the dinginess and dust and across more than 50 years. The eyes, which were Cass Mastern, stared out of a long, bony face, but a young face with full lips above a rather thin, curly black beard. The lips did not seem to belong to that bony face and the burning eyes. The young man in the picture, standing, visible from the thighs up, wore a loose-fitting, shapeless jacket, too large in the collar, short in the sleeves to show strong wrists and bony hands clasped at the waist. The thick, dark hair, combed sweepingly back from the high brow, came down long and square-cut, after the fashion of time, place, and class, almost to brush the collar of the coarse hand-me-down-looking jacket, which was the jacket of an infantryman in the Confederate Army. But everything in the picture, in contrast with the dark, burning eyes, seemed accidental. That jacket, however, was not accidental. It was worn as the result of calculation and anguish, in pride and self-humiliation, in the conviction that it would be worn in death. But the death was not to be that quick and easy. It was to come slow and hard in a stinking hospital in Atlanta. The last letter in the packet was not in Cass Mastern's hand. Lying in the hospital with his rotting wound, he dictated his farewell letter to his brother, Gilbert Mastern. The letter, and the last of the account books in which Cass Mastern's journal was kept, were eventually sent back home to Mississippi, and Cass Mastern was buried somewhere in Atlanta, nobody had ever known where. It was, in a sense, proper that Cass Mastern, in the gray jacket, sweat-stiffened and prickly like a hair shirt, which it was for him at the same time that it was the insignia of a begrudged glory, should have gone back to Georgia to rot slowly to death. For he had been born in Georgia, he and Gilbert Mastern and Lavinia Mastern, in the Red Hills up toward Tennessee. "I was born," the first page of the first volume of the journal said, "in a log cabin in North Georgia, in circumstances of poverty, and if in later years I have lain soft and supped from silver, may the Lord not let die in my heart the knowledge of frost and of coarse diet. For all men come naked into the world, and in prosperity man is prone to evil as the sparks fly upward." The lines were written when Cass was a student at Transylvania College up in Kentucky, after what he called his darkness and trouble had given place to the peace of God. For the journal began with an account of the darkness and trouble, which was a perfectly real trouble, with a dead man and a live woman and long nail scratches down Cass Mastern's bony face. "I write this down," he said in the journal, "with what truthfulness a sinner may attain unto, that if ever pride is in me, of flesh or spirit, I can peruse these pages and know with shame what evil has been in me, and may be in me, for who knows what breeze may blow upon the charred log and fan up flame again." The impulse to write the journal sprang from the darkness and trouble. But Cass Mastern apparently had a systematic mind, and so he went back to the beginning, to the log cabin in the Red Hills of Georgia. It was the older brother, Gilbert, some 15 years older than Cass, who lifted the family from the log cabin. Gilbert, who had run away from home when a boy and gone west to Mississippi, was well on the way to being a cotton snob by the time he was in his 30s, that is, by 1850. The penniless and no doubt hungry boy walking barefoot onto the black soil of Mississippi was to become, 10 or 12 years later, the master sitting the spirited roan stallion, its name was Powhatan, that from the journal, in front of the white veranda. How did Gilbert make his first dollar? Did he cut the throat of a traveler in the canebrake? Did he black boots at an inn? It's not recorded. But he made his fortune and sat on the white veranda and voted Whig. After the war, when the white veranda was a pile of ashes and the fortune was gone, it was not surprising that Gilbert, who had made one fortune with his bare hands out of the very air, could now, with all his experience and cunning and hardness, the hardness harder now for the 4 years of riding and short rations and disappointment, snatch another one, much greater than the first. If in later years he ever remembered his brother Cass and took out the last letter, the one dictated in the hospital in Atlanta, he must have mused over it with a tolerant irony. For it said, "Remember me, but without grief. If one of us is lucky, it is I. I shall have rest, and I hope in the mercy of the everlasting and in his blessed election. But you, my dear brother, are condemned to eat bread in bitterness, and build on the place where the charred embers and ashes are, and to make bricks without straw, and to suffer in the ruin and guilt of our dear land and in the common guilt of man. In the next bed to me there's a young man from Ohio. He's dying. His moans and curses and prayers are not different from any others to be heard in this tabernacle of pain. He marched hither in his guilt as I in mine, and in the guilt of his land. May a common salvation lift us both from the dust. And, dear brother, I pray God to give you strength for what is to come." Gilbert must have smiled looking back, for he had eaten little bread in bitterness. He had had his own kind of strength. By 1870, he was again well off. By 1875 or 76, he was rich. By 1880, he had a fortune, was living in New York, was a name, a thick, burly man, slow of movement, with a head like a block of bare granite. He had lived out of one world into another. Perhaps he was even more at home in the new than in the old. Or perhaps the Gilbert Masterns are always at home in any world, as the Cass Masterns are never at home in any world. But to return, Jack Burden came into possession of the papers from the grandson of Gilbert Mastern. When the time came for him to select a subject for his dissertation for his Ph.D., his professor suggested that he edit the journal and letters of Cass Mastern and write a biographical essay, a social study, based on those and other materials. So Jack Burden began his first journey into the past. It seemed easy at first. It was easy to reconstruct the life of the log cabin in the Red Hills. There were the first letters back from Gilbert after he had begun his rise. Jack Burden managed to get possession of the other Gilbert Mastern papers of the period before the Civil War. There was the known pattern of that life, gradually altered toward comfort as Gilbert's affluence was felt at that distance. Then, in one season, the mother and father died, and Gilbert returned to burst, no doubt, upon Cass and Lavinia as an unbelievable vision, a splendid impostor in black broadcloth, varnished boots, white linen, heavy gold ring. He put Lavinia in a school in Atlanta, bought her trunks of dresses, and kissed her goodbye. "Could you not have taken me with you, dear brother Gilbert? I would have been ever so dutiful and affectionate a sister." So she wrote him in the copybook hand in brown ink, in a language not her own, a language of schoolroom propriety. "May I not come to you now? Is there no little task which I—" But Gilbert had other plans. When the time came for her to appear at his house, she would be ready. But he took Cass with him, a hobbledehoy now wearing black and mounted on a blooded mare. At the end of 3 years, Cass was not a hobbledehoy. He had spent 3 years of monastic rigor at Valhalla, Gilbert's house, under the tuition of a Mr. Lawson and of Gilbert himself. From Gilbert he learned the routine of plantation management. From Mr. Lawson, a tubercular and vague young man from Princeton, New Jersey, he learned some geometry, some Latin, and a great deal of Presbyterian theology. He liked the books, and once Gilbert, so the journal said, stood in the doorway and watched him bent over the table and then said, "At least you may be good for that." But he was good for more than that. When Gilbert gave him a small plantation, he managed it for 2 years with such astuteness, and such luck, for both season and market conspired in his behalf, that at the end of the time he could repay Gilbert a substantial part of the purchase price. Then he went or was sent to Transylvania. It was Gilbert's idea. He came into the house on Cass's plantation one night to find Cass at his books. He walked across the room to the table where the books lay, by which Cass now stood. Gilbert stretched out his arm and tapped the open book with his riding crop. "You might make something out of that," he said. The journal reported that, but it did not report what book it was that Gilbert's riding crop tapped. It's not important what book it was, or perhaps it is important, for something in our mind and our imagination wants to know that fact. We see the red, square, strong hand, my brother is strong-made and florid, protruding from the white cuff, grasping the crop which in that grasp looks fragile like a twig. We see the flick of the little leather loop on the open page, a flick brisk, not quite contemptuous, but we cannot make out the page. In any case, it probably was not a book on theology, for it seems doubtful that Gilbert, in such a case, would have used the phrase, "make something out of that." It might have been a page of the Latin poets, however, for Gilbert would have discovered that in small doses they went well with politics or the law. So Transylvania College it was to be, suggested it developed by Gilbert's neighbor and friend, Mr. Davis, Mr. Jefferson Davis, who had once been a student there. Mr. Davis had studied Greek. At Transylvania, in Lexington, Cass discovered pleasure. "I discovered that there is an education for vice as well as for virtue, and I learned what was to be learned from the gaming table, the bottle, and the race course, and from the illicit sweetness of the flesh. He had come out of the poverty of the cabin and the monastic regime of Valhalla and the responsibilities of his own little plantation, and he was tall and strong and, to judge from the photographs, well-favored with the burning dark eyes. It was no wonder that he discovered pleasure, or that pleasure discovered him, for though the journal does not say so, in the events leading up to the darkness and trouble, Cass seems to have been, in the beginning at least, the pursued rather than the pursuer. The pursuer is referred to in the journal as she and her. But Jack Burden learned the name. She was Annabel Trice, Mrs. Duncan Trice, and Mr. Duncan Trice was a prosperous young banker of Lexington, Kentucky, who was an intimate of Cass Mastern and apparently one of those who led him into the paths of pleasure. Jack Burden learned the name by going back to the files of the Lexington newspapers for the middle 1850s to locate the story of a death. It was the death of Mr. Duncan Trice. In the newspaper, it was reported as an accident. Duncan Trice had shot himself by accident, the newspaper said, while cleaning a pair of pistols. One of the pistols, already cleaned, lay on the couch where he had been sitting, in his library, at the time of the accident. The other, the lethal instrument, had fallen to the floor. Jack Burden had known, from the journal, the nature of the case, and so when he had located the special circumstances, he had learned the identity of she. Mr. Trice, the newspaper said, was survived by his widow, née Annabel Puckett, of Washington, D.C. Shortly after Cass had come to Lexington, Annabel Trice met him. Duncan Trice brought him home, for he had received a letter from Mr. Davis recommending the brother of his good friend and neighbor, Mr. Gilbert Mastern. Duncan Trice had come to Lexington from southern Kentucky, where his own father had been a friend of Samuel Davis, the father of Jefferson, when Samuel lived at Fairview and bred racers. So Duncan Trice brought the tall boy home, who was no longer a hobbledehoy, and set him on a sofa and thrust a glass into his hand and called in his pretty, husky-voiced wife, of whom he was so proud, to greet the stranger. When she first entered the room, in which the shades of approaching twilight were gathering, though the hour for the candles to be lit had scarcely come, I thought that her eyes were black, and the effect was most striking, her hair being of such a fairness. I noticed, too, how softly she trod, and with a gliding motion which, though she was perhaps of a little less than moderate stature, gave an impression of regal dignity. Et avertens rosea cervique refulsit, ambrosiaeque comae divinum vertice odorem spiruere. Pedes vestis defluxit animos, et vera incessu patuit dea. So the Mantuan said, when Venus appeared and the true goddess was revealed by her gait. She came into the room and was the true goddess as revealed in her movement and was, but for divine grace, if such be granted to a parcel of corruption such as I, my true damnation. She gave me her hand and spoke with a tingling huskiness, which made me think of rubbing my hand upon a soft, deep-piled cloth like velvet or upon a fur. It would not have been called a musical voice such as is generally admired. I know that, but I can only set down what effect it worked upon my own organs of hearing. Cass set down a very conscientious description of every feature and proportion, a kind of tortured inventory, as though in the midst of the darkness and trouble, at the very moment of his agony and repudiation, he had to take one last backward look, even at the risk of being turned into the pillar of salt. Her face was not large, though a little given to fullness. Her mouth was strong, but the lips were red and moist, and seemed to be slightly parted or about to part themselves. The chin was short and firmly molded. Her skin was of a great whiteness. It seemed then before the candles were lit, but afterwards I was to see that it had a bloom of color upon it. Her hair, which was in a remarkable abundance and of great fairness, was drawn back from her face and worn in large coils low down to the neck. Her waist was very small, and her breasts, which seemed naturally high and round and full, were the higher for the corseting. Her dress, of a dark blue silk, I remember, was cut low to the very downward curve of the shoulders, and in the front showed how the breasts were lifted like twin orbs. Cass described her that way. He admitted that her face was not beautiful, though agreeable in its proportions, he added. But the hair was beautiful, and of an astonishing softness upon your hand, softer and finer than your thought of silk. So even in that moment, in the midst of the darkness and trouble, the recollection intrudes into the journal of how that abundant fair hair had slipped across his fingers. But, he added, her beauty was her eyes. He had remarked how, when she first came in, into the shadowy room, her eyes had seemed black. But he had been mistaken, he was to discover, and that discovery was the first step toward his undoing. After the greeting, she greeted me with great simplicity and courtesy and bade me again take my seat. She remarked on how dark the room was and how the autumn always came to take one unawares. Then she touched a bell pull and a Negro boy entered. She commanded him to bring light and to mend the fire, which was sunk to ash or near so. He came back presently with a 7-branched candlestick, which he put upon the table back of the couch on which I sat. He struck a lucifer, but she said, "Let me light the candles." I remember it as if it were only yesterday when I sat on that couch. I had turned my head idly to watch her light the candles. The little table was between us. She leaned over the candles and applied the lucifer to the wicks, one after another. She was leaning over, and I saw how the corset lifted her breasts together, but because she was leaning, the eyelids shaded her eyes from my sight. Then she raised her head a little and looked straight at me over the new candle flames, and I saw all at once that her eyes were not black. They were blue, but a blue so deep that I can only compare it to the color of the night sky in autumn when the weather is clear and there is no moon and the stars have just well come out. And I had not known how large they were. I remember saying that to myself with perfect clearness. I had not known how large they were, several times, slowly, like a man marveling. Then I knew that I was blushing, and I felt my tongue dry like ashes in my mouth, and I was in the manly state. I can see perfectly clearly the expression on her face even now, but I cannot interpret it. Sometimes I have thought of it as having a smiling hidden in it, but I cannot be sure. I'm only sure of this, that man is never safe and damnation is ever at hand, O God and my Redeemer. I sat there, one hand clenched upon my knee and the other holding an empty glass, and I felt that I could not breathe. Then she said to her husband, who stood in the room behind me, "Duncan, do you see that Mr. Maston is in need of refreshment?" The year passed. Cass, who was a good deal younger than Duncan Trice, and as a matter of fact several years younger than Annabel Trice, became a close companion of Duncan Trice and learned much from him, for Duncan Trice was rich, fashionable, clever, and high-spirited, much given to laughter and full-blooded. Duncan Trice led Cass to the bottle, the gaming table, and the race course, but not to the illicit sweetness of the flesh. Duncan Trice was passionately and single-mindedly devoted to his wife. When she came into a room, his eyes would fix upon her without shame, and I have seen her avert her face and blush for the boldness of his glance when company was present. But I think that it was done by him unawares his partiality for her was so great. No, the other young men, members of the Trice circle, led Cass first to the illicit sweetness. But despite the new interests and gratifications, Cass could work at his books. There was even time for that, for he had great strength and endurance. So the year passed. He had been much in the Trice house, but no word beyond the words of merriment and civility had passed between him and Annabel Trice. In June, there was a dancing party at the house of some friend of Duncan Trice. Duncan Trice, his wife, and Cass happened to stroll at some moment into the garden and to sit in a little arbor which was covered with a jasmine vine. Duncan Trice returned to the house to get punch for the three of them, leaving Annabel and Cass seated side by side in the arbor. Cass commented on the sweetness of the scent of jasmine. All at once, she burst out, her voice low-pitched and with its huskiness, but in a vehemence which astonished me. "Yes, yes, it is too sweet. It is suffocating. I shall suffocate." and she laid her right hand, with the fingers spread, across the bare swell of her bosom above the pressure of the corset. Thinking her taken by some sudden illness, Cass recorded in the journal, I asked if she were faint. She said no in a very low, husky voice.